thank you, first of all for coming to the Ruth Kalman Memorial Lecture, our fourth year honor, memory of my mother, Aleha Shalom. We've had some wonderful speakers in the past, and we'll continue, as you'll see very soon, in that tradition. This week's Parsha, Parshat Balotcha, begins with a description of the menorah, of the candelabra that we had every single day lit in the Beit HaMikdash, in the temple. The Parsha begins by describing the method of lighting the menorah. And the Torah tells us that Daber la'aron v'amarta elav v'halotcha taneirot en mul pnei ha'menorah ya'iru shivat taneirot. The Torah tells us that, first of all, that the mitzvah, the commandment is to Aaron, that these lights, the seven lights of the menorah, have to be lit every single day. And there's a emphasis on the idea of halotcha, when you light the menorah. And Rashi points out in a very famous statement, Rashi tells us, Hashem shala of ola, the idea that the flame rises up, that you have to make sure when you light the menorah that the actual flame takes on its own life, is able to stand by itself. And I think this idea is really appropriate when talking about parents, and especially my mother, that while each of us, speaking on behalf of my brother, my sister, when we think about our mother, we miss her dearly every single day. And yet, she gave us the tools that, for us at least, we can go on. She gave us the chinuch, the education, that we can go be olem me'aleha. She made sure to be with us, to teach us in actions and deeds and words every single day, to give us the foundation in which we can carry on in our lives, even though it's never the same. No matter how old you are, when you lose a parent, you'll always be your mother's child, and we feel like that all the time. But we also, as we stand here today, we thank her deeply for giving us those tools that we can go on in life, and constantly remindful of the messages that she taught to us every single day. The Parsha continues in describing the actual building of the menorah. It tells us that it has to be miksham. It has to be from one block, as Rashi points out. It can't be me'evarim, evarim. It's not, when the menorah was fashioned, it wasn't fashioned from various types of blocks of various pieces. It was actually one mold. And talking about the speaker, I think that's very appropriate. Not only is Rabbi Terigen a very solid person, and I can tell you that from knowing him for almost 20 years, going back to our year together in Gush Etzion, learning together, knowing him as a very solid football player and other types of sporting abilities, which we won't get into right now. But really, Rabbi Terigen is an incredibly solid person in every sense of the word. As I mentioned, I've had the pleasure of knowing him for a long time. We've been very close friends over that time, and he's really, I think, one of the people that I always have looked up to in all levels of his life, in both his learning, his incredible hasmada. Rabbi Terigen was always among the last people in the Beis Medrash every night, and he still is like that. Tremendous hasmada, even though he has six kids. That might we have to wish him a mazel tov. He just celebrated the bat mitzvah of his daughter 3 weeks ago, so mazel tov on that. And it's very appropriate that we have been speaking in memory of my mother, the fact that we know each other, and special for me at least, that somebody that I know is speaking in her honor. But again, he represents all of the good things that my mother really lived for and was about, the tremendous passion that she had for learning in all senses, for herself, for her children, for everybody. And Rabbi Terigen, as I mentioned, is really a great role model. We have many of his Talmidim, many of his students here. He's known as really one of the top stars in Israel in the yeshivot. People look up to him, they flock to him to hear him, both in Gush Etzion and Yeshivat Har Etzion, and in the lectures that he gives throughout Israel. He really is a beacon for many of the young students that come there, can come to be transformed during their year or 2 years or even longer in Israel. So it gives me tremendous pleasure and pride really to have him as a friend, for him to be here, and to really learn from him, as we will, I'm sure, over this next hour. Thank you. I just wanted to mention to you just a technical matter. There are two sheets that Rabbi Terigen has prepared, so make sure you have two sheets, and also anybody who's not signed in on Rabbi Kalman, my brother's email list. There are sheets at the table. If you've not signed in, please make sure to sign in.
Thank you.
On your side, that's it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah, thank you.
Perfect. Wednesday evening, last night, I sat at my kitchen table with my children, listening to their complaints. Abba, you have to travel again. Fortunately or unfortunately, I find myself traveling more often than I'd like on behalf of the yeshiva. And my 11-year-old looked at me and said, Abba, can't you stay home? So I explained to them that one of the most special people in my life was about to celebrate a simcha that I wouldn't miss for the world. As you know, something that the person who introduced me didn't mention. This is a very special, meaningful weekend for Mishpachas Kelman, for the Kelman family. Of course, this is a shir dedicated to their mother, Aleha Shalom, wife. But it's also Monday evening, and Mirtz Hashem, the Chasana of Rav Mori Kelman, who has been one of my special influences, one of my special lights and beacons over the last 20 years. And I said that so much of our experiences as his friends over the years have been the subject of so much joy and sharing on his behalf that I wouldn't miss his chasana for the world. There's nothing that could keep me away. So Baruch Hashem, it was a trip well worth taking, hopefully a lesson to my daughter, well worth learning. And I just want to thank the Kelman family for inviting me to be part of both ends of this meaningful weekend. And they really aren't brackets, they really are one unified moment. I think that the greatest testament, the greatest light, and the greatest reflection of everything that Ruth Aleha Shalom stood for us will clearly be seen in Mirtz Hashem Monday evening. Mirtz Hashem, Abba Aleinu L'Tova. So I want to thank you for that somewhat inflated introduction, but more importantly for being part of your simcha and being part of your family. The past couple of years, we've witnessed a very troubling and in many ways dangerous phenomenon. An unholy alliance between terror and religion. Between fundamentalism, strict, inflexible adherence to fundamentals, and fanaticism. Between devotion, piety, religious commitment, and destruction, carnage, and death. In North America, of course, this came to a head about 2 years ago, on September 11th. In Eretz Yisrael, we've been facing this for close to a decade. Of course, the last couple years of the Intifada has witnessed an intensification of sorts. As Westerners, we instinctively are repulsed by fundamentalist terror, by Islamic fundamentalism, and certainly the manifestations that we are all victim of. But if we assess this movement a little bit more carefully, noticing its subtleties, not just its broad strokes, we find that there are many aspects and many components of these movements which are quite similar, which we quite identify with, as of the Hashem, Neshamei Torah mitzvos. If, for example, we assess the laws of modesty, in particular the way that we dress and the attention we place on dress, we find ourselves in some instances much closer to these cultures than to the encircling Christian culture. If we inspect family values, the role, the function, the centrality of family within building a society, certainly these cultures place an emphasis on family life, which is highly reminiscent of our own emphasis. If we consider chesed, not chesed merely in the institutional sense, in that respect, we have a lot to be proud of, organizations, institutions, but chesed in the interpersonal sense, person to person, heart to heart, human being to human being, That type of chesed is clearly one of the hallmarks of Islamic society, and in particular, of Islamic fundamentalist society. Need I remind you that Hamas, the great enemy of ours, had its roots as a charity organization, pretty much as a gemach, handing out to the needy, supporting the destitute. But if there's one area in which the parity, the equivalence between our own lives, our own religious consciousness, and Islamic fundamentalism is glaring, it's in the very definition of fundamentalism and in the willingness to sacrifice everything, even our lives, on behalf of that belief. Who must not acknowledge, who will not concede, that in the end of the day, we're all fundamentalists? If fundamentalism is defined as a strict, unwavering adherence to fundamental principles of life, of ethics, of morality, which were laid down thousands of years ago through a divine delivery, which are impregnable to the passages of time, which are not altered by the changes and sweeps of history. If that is how we define fundamentalists, then we are all fundamentalists. And we dare not define ourselves as anything less. Sometimes our language can be a bit confusing. We have to be careful about the semantics we employ and the vernacular we use to describe our world, and in particular to describe ourselves. For example, sometimes we refer to certain sections of the Orthodox community as ultra-Orthodox. Does any of us have any right or privilege to be anything less? Can a Jew aspire to be anything less than ultra-Orthodox, anything less than perfect? Perhaps other terms are more appropriate, terms which reflect socio-demographic differences rather than religious gradations. But not only are we fundamentalists, we are fundamentalists, and one of the central tenets of our creed, of our heritage, of our religious journey, is the willingness, the pride, to sacrifice our lives on behalf of our God, on behalf of our love for our God, when called. Who in this room isn't the product of Mesiras Nefesh al Kiddush Hashem? Who in this room doesn't have a relative, isn't aware of a story of a Jew who was faced with the dilemma, with the challenge, his love for God or his life, and proudly and triumphantly offered his life to glorify and to sanctify Kodesh Baruch Hu? How different is this, really, from a suicide bomber, Yimach Shemo, who also believes that he is sacrificing his life or her life on behalf of their God? What are the differences between the hallowed principle of Ve'ahavtas Hashem Elokecha b'chol levavcha b'chol nafshecha b'chol miyodecha, you should love your God with your soul, with your heart, even if he takes your life, and these cruel, bestial suicide bombers who are guilty of such carnage? That, I believe, is a very pressing question. And it's a question which, of course, is too complicated to encapsulate, to solve completely in the span of an hour, or under an hour. But allow me this evening to present a few guidelines, a few differences, some of the more glaring differences which define our religion at its roots, are part and parcel of religious consciousness, and serve to discriminate between these vulgar, repulsive behaviors and our own religious pursuits. The first difference speaks to the manner in which man envisions his God. What is our image of Hashem? What is our vision? What is our definition of God? Well, the Torah tells us, source number one, a pasuk in Vayikra, Ushmartem eschukosai ves mishpatai, should heed my laws, page number one, Asher yase osam ha'adam v'chai bohem, ani Hashem. Torah, Judaism, is a life-embracing religion. It's not meant to suppress or to stifle human experience, but to ennoble it, to inspire it, to redeem it, to uplift it. Religion is not meant to cause death.
It's meant to celebrate life, to champion life, and to embrace it. God is not a blood-loving God. He doesn't lust after revenge. He doesn't desire human sacrifice. He doesn't covet murder. He covets life and peace and prosperity. It advances the human condition rather than retards it. The very famous Rambam, which is built on this pasuk. To me, it's one of the Rambams, one of the few Rambams which a person should study and sort of emblazon on his consciousness. The Rambam, source number 3, the Chashavas Parak Beis, Halacha Gimel, describes the laws of someone who is deathly ill on Shabbos. In an instance of Pikuach Nefesh, where someone's life hangs in the balance, so Pikuach Nefesh is Delche Shabbos. We violate Shabbos to drive the ambulance, to provide medical care, or anything else that's necessary to alleviate the medical condition, even if it desecrates the Shabbos. The Rambam writes, source number 3, Kisha Osin Divarim Ha'ilu, when we desecrate the Shabbos, Ein Osin Osam Lo'i De'Nachim V'Lo'i De'Ktanim V'Lo'i De'Avadim V'Lo'i De'Nashim. Don't assume that inasmuch as we're violating Shabbos, let's delegate this violation to inferior members of our environment. Let's ask the children to violate Shabbos. Let's ask the servants. In the Rambam's historical context, as you know, women were seen as inferior. There's no chauvinism here. The Rambam's writing in his own context. Let the women be Mechallel Shabbos. But that we should be Mechallel Shabbos, let's delegate these tasks to other people. Line number 2, the end of the line. Source number 3. Ela yidei gidoli yisrael v'chachmeyem. The rabbi should be driving the ambulance. The Rosh Yeshiva, the tzaddik, the gadol, should be the one issuing the medical care. The asur mismameh v'chilul Shabbos. You cannot waver, you cannot tarry, you cannot delay. Well, maybe we'll hold out, and the situation will be alleviated on its own. Shenemar, line number 4. Asher yaseh also ha'adam l'chai b'hem, v'lo sheyamus b'hem. The purpose, the objective of religion is life and not death. And here, of course, the Rambam editorializes. Listen to this line carefully, the end of line 4. Ha lamadata she'ein mishpitei ha'Torah nekama ba'olam. The Torah's purpose is not revenge and death. Ela rachamim v'chesed v'shalom. Purpose of the Torah, the purpose of Rachmana, is rachamim chayim v'shalom, harmony, mercy, compassion. And now the Rambam has harsh words for people who distort this message. The elu apikorsim, an apikoros, sha'omim shezeh chilul Shabbos, who abstain and maintain that this is indeed chilul Shabbos and medical treatment should be delivered. The author, Alein HaKosav Omer, about them the Torah writes, and the Rambam here refers to Yechezkel Perikhav. Some of you might want to scan that in source number 2. Alein HaKosav Omer, Gam Ani Nasati Lam Chukim Lo Tovim U'Mishpatim Lo Yechiv Bahem. They perverted a Torah which is supposed to be B'chai Bahem into Chukim Lo Tovim U'Mishpatim Lo Yechiv Bahem. HaKadosh Baruch Hu delivers this code, this system, to enhance, to redeem, to lend us more dignity. He is a lover of life, not a pursuer or coveter of death. This is the first distortion of religion which has been committed. That God is happy? Remember the hands in Ramallah? The blood-stained hands raised in a sign of victory? As if God celebrates human death, chas v'shalom? When human beings suffer, they are creatures of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and they are deserving of our compassion and our pity, our attendance and our assistance, because they possess Tzelem Elokim. Whether they are colleagues, and part of our nation, or brothers, or even our enemies. When homeless people in Iraq suffer, our hearts should be torn. not necessarily as deeply as it's torn when Jews suffer. When innocent Palestinians, I'm not talking about people who are directly involved in terror, but innocent Palestinians are just us, who have been trained to see us as their enemy, but when they suffer, I'm not necessarily suggesting this should dictate our policy, our political or military policy, but at a human level, is that Kodesh Baruch Hu happy? Is there a victory dance in Shemayim? The Egyptians, our tormentors for hundreds of years, were drowned in the Red Sea. You dare say Shira? HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not covet blood. HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not desire human sacrifice. These are not part of religion. These invaders, these are invasive of religion. HaKadosh Baruch Hu dragged Avraham Avinu up to Har Moriah, brought him to the brink of human sacrifice. The knife was drawn, the blade was glistening in the sun. Al tishlach yadcha el hanar, v'al tas lo meruma. He brought Avraham Avinu to the brink of human sacrifice, only to illustrate, al tas lo meruma. I don't desire korbanos of human life. Rashi points out, source number 5, Al Tishlach, page number 2, Lishchot. Don't sacrifice Yitzchak. Amar Lo. So Avraham complained. L'china ba'asim l'kan. Rebbeinu Shalom, so much courage, so much fervor, so much conviction, so much defiance these last 3 days to bring my son here. How could you know the turmoil in my heart? And I've overcome it. If I can't shecht him, Esed al Chavala, top line. At least let me slice his neck. At least let me draw blood. At least let me do something to express my passion, my intensity, my faith. Amar le al tas lo meuma, al tas evamu. I don't want death. I don't desire blood. I don't want Yitzchak to be injured. He is to return unscathed. Avraham Avinu's great message to mankind was the twinning between religion and life. It is not incidental that Avraham was both the Yisha Chesed, Titin Emes Liakov, the Chesed LeAvraham, as well as the great philosopher who discovered HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the father of monotheism, Istakiel Babira, the Hikir Esbaro. Avraham performed these two functions, but not as separate tasks, as one integrated message. That religion is meant to improve the human condition, to alleviate human suffering, to advance the standard of living. If he is to be the greatest philosopher, he must also be the champion of Chesed. Man at that point had already discovered that religion can lead to a higher state of human perfection. There was a man, there was a city, there was a community who finally deciphered the message that religion is meant to complete, to perfect, to refine the human soul. That man's name was Malki Tzedek. And the place and the city he inhabited was Shali. Malki Tzedek was a Kohen, a priest, a religious clergyman. And he lived in the city of Shalem, the city which was called because it would produce or facilitate human perfection, Shlemus. After consecutive failures, the Dar Mabul, the Dar Flaga, after failing to improve the human lot, people turned back to religion, to the Kohen, in order to attain Shlemus. Malki Tzedek Melech Shalem. Avraham, of course, added one component to the religious experience. True shleimus cannot be reached solely on human terms, even if those human terms are inspired by a divine presence. True shleimus can only emerge from an encounter with a transcendent God. Religion is a thrust beyond the human realm to a higher realm, an encounter, a rendezvous with a different being. And Avraham contributed the first part of that city's name. The city was already called Shalem. And Avraham added the prefix Yerah. That Shlemos is only a product of encounter, of Gilui Shlina, of man standing before God, clinging to God, obeying God, being inspired by God. Parshas Vayera begins with the first Gilui Shlina in history, Vayera Elav Hashem Be'elonei Marei, V'hu Yoshev Pesach Ha'ol Kechom Hayom. Why did Hashem come to Avraham that morning? There were plenty of malachim to perform different tasks, to heal Sarah, to inform Sarah, to save Lot. Why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu come to Avraham that morning? He came to come, to inaugurate the process of Gilui Shlina. Until that point, HaKadosh Baruch Hu had commanded man, had punished man, had signed treaties with man and taken oaths to man, but had yet to appear to man. And Avraham was the first person to reach the state of Tmimus. His Hamlech Lefanai Ve'ye Tamim, which is a higher state than Shlemos. He was a Tamim. And he now was capable of encountering the Shechina. Vayera Elav Hashem Elonei Marei, V'hu Yoshei Pesach Ha'ol Kechom Hayom. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu appears to him. Parshas Vayera begins with Gilui Shechina, with Yeraya Vayera Elav Hashem. And it concludes with Gilui Shechina. The Har Hashem Yeraya. The only difference, of course, is that in the beginning of the parasha, God comes to man. In the end of the parasha, man has to find God. Man has to seek God. Hashem doesn't tell Avraham which mountain to sacrifice Yitzchak. Ma'alei Hashem li'olah al-achad yarim asher mari lecha. This is the great message of monotheism. This is the great message of our heritage. This is the great message of the Judeo-Christian tradition. That religion is not the enemy of life, but its greatest supporter, its greatest grace. That religion is meant to redeem the human experience by allowing a thrust into a transcendent realm. By and large, our world is divided more or less into two cultures. Those cultures that are built upon the monotheistic tradition of Judaism, of Christianity, by and large enjoy a high standard of living, medical coverage, economic stability, political freedom. By and large, those cultures which are still mired in the paganistic world of old, by and large, those cultures do not enjoy these same truths, do not enjoy these same standards, are still stricken with poverty, with political persecution, with inept medical coverage, with fragile societies. The great message of Avraham Avinu was illustrated at the top of our memoria. Al tishlach yachel anar, v'al taslo me'uma. Do not injure the child. Do not sacrifice him. Do not draw his blood. Ei mishtete ha-Torah nekama ba'olam, as the Rambam writes. The laws of the Torah are not vengeful and bloodlust. El rachamim v'chayim v'shalom. This is, of course, the first difference. What happens to a culture that views its God as wrathful, as angry, as a God who seeks retribution, as opposed to what happens to a culture which views its God as peaceful and just, merciful? In the name, of course, of Bernard Lewis, what went wrong? Look, many of you must have seen. How did the Islamic culture go from the superior position it maintained throughout much of the medieval era to the clearly inferior position which it possesses in today's world, the cause of so much Muslim rage? What led to the Renaissance, to the Industrial Revolution, to the achievement of democracy, What stirred these movements in Western civilization? In part because we view our God as just and a lover of life and a desire of peace. And if our world wasn't perfect, well, it became our religious mission to perfect it. If humans suffered, if we're a victim to the forces of nature, if we're a victim to the abuses of man, then it became not just our human charge, but our religious destiny to improve, to discover, to inquire, to advance technology, medicine, science, political freedom. The unfurling of the human spirit is very much part of the religious quest to discover God and to perfect the world which He endowed us with. What happens to a culture which views its God as wrathful and vengeful? Is there any more motivation to perfect that world? Is there any desire to change its terms, to perfect its flaws? If God Himself does not desire life and prosperity, why should man act as his proxy? Eimish tefei atar nekama ba'olam, ela rachamim v'chayim v'chesed ba'olam. The second difference between the hallowed image of Mesiras Nefesh al Kiddush Hashem and a suicide bomber, Yimach Shemo, is the motive. Not just the image of Hashem, the image of God, but the motive. What is the motive which drives a suicide bomber? When these bombers are interviewed prior to their dastardly missions, what do they feel awaits them in heaven at the end of this mission? We've all heard it. We've all cringed. The 72 virgins. A human being who sacrifices his life for 72 virgins, whose name is he sanctifying? Whose purpose is he serving? Whose goal is he sacrificing for? His God? Or his own lust, his own carnal desires, that which is base and vile within him? Throughout our history, not one single Jew went to the stake or to the gas chamber solely to merit that ticket to the next world. But because of the pasuk I mentioned before, "V'yachdas Hashem Elokecha b'chol levavecha u'b'chol nafshecha u'b'chol miyodecha," the love we feel for this invisible, mysterious being is so deep, is so passionate, that if forced to, we're even willing to die for it, rather than allow its clarity to be compromised. There is an astounding Gemara in Pesachim, which for years perplexed me. Baruch Hashem, just recently I think I understand its gist. Verse number 6. Tashma, Pesachim Nun Gimel. Od Zim Darash Tudus Ishromi. Tudus from Rome provided the following drasha. Ma'ara Uchananya Mishael Vazaria Shemasu Atzma Makadisha Sashay Makishanesh. There stood Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah facing the greatest calling, the most challenging moment a Jew can experience. Defy Nebuchadnezzar and be thrown into the Kibshan Aish, into the fiery furnace, or renege on your faith, on your conviction, on your religion. What inspired them? What moved Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah to such courage? If Chas V'Shalom, any of us were put into that situation, who would we draw inspiration from? Which images would we conjure up? Which great heroic Jewish lives would move us? Avram, Yosef HaTzadik, perhaps Moshe Rabbeinu? Who did Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah think of at that moment? The Gemara says, source number 6:2. They thought about the frogs. Here they were, this epic climactic moment, thinking about reptiles. What do they think about? Umat Svardim, She'im Mitzvah al Kiddushas Hashem, Ksivu. The frogs have no commandment to love God, and yet about them is written, Uvaru vialu b'veisecha, uvitan recha, v'mishar asecha, Mitzrayim, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu called them to battle, they eagerly flung themselves into Paro's furnaces, into his ovens, to create greater havoc. Emasai Misharis Mitzvah Zeisoltanor, and the Omer B'Shah Shatan Archam, the ovens were hot. If the frogs were Moser Nefesh HaKadosh Hashem, Avirush and Mitzvah, we have a command, Allah has come of a come. God did Himmel. The frogs, of all the creatures to draw inspiration from, all the heroic Jewish lives spent glorifying HaKadosh Baruch Hu's name, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah needed a Musar Shmuz and the frogs? The answer, I believe, is as follows. Because a Jew does not sacrifice his life for schar, for Olam Haba. He sacrifices it to sanctify, to glorify, Masakin Olam Malchus Shakai. We're put onto this earth to sanctify, to serve, to create greater awareness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And we serve that purpose with every breath that we're given. When that breath is taken from us, we continue to glorify. And this message, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, could only draw from a creature which does not have an afterlife. There is no Olam Haba for frogs. There is no great pond in the sky to which the virtuous frogs alight to enjoy an eternal feast of flies. Frogs are mortal. They have no more immortality. And from the frog's example, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah derived the notion that a Jew sacrifices his life for his God, not for his own purposes, not for his own afterlife, not chas v'shalom for his own rewards. There's a famous story which took place at the Umschlagplatz near the ghetto of Kovna. The Jews were gathered, were assembled one morning for that great euphemism called an action. You know, an action when Jews were trotted out by the thousands and tens of thousands to be slaughtered in the forest. And as the Jews were gathering at the Umschlagplatz, a halachic question arose. What bracha is recited when performing the mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem? Kiddush Hashem, of course, is a mitzvah which a person only performs once in his life, if at all. And after a person performs that mitzvah, he no longer is around to deliver the tradition to others. So there is no clear-cut tradition which bracha to recite on Kiddush Hashem. And they were scurrying around trying to ask someone who had some knowledge, some tradition. Finally, they found the grandson of Rav Chanan Wasserman who had some mesorah from the Chafetz Chaim, what type of bracha to recite. To the casual observer, this scene is nothing less than pitiful. Pathetic. A few minutes left to live. Spend time with your family. Arrange your affairs. Enjoy the fall weather. What bracha to make, this way or that way? But to us, it is nothing less than triumphant. One more mitzvah. I'm being taken from this world. As I'm taken, I'm serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu, sanctifying Hashem's name, demonstrating to others my deep-seated conviction in a God I'll never see, in an image I can never describe. How can I best serve Him with this last mitzvah, my final mitzvah? How can I best perform? Were they thinking about Olam Haba? Were they thinking about the great rewards which awaited them? Or were they thinking about the Nikdashti B'Soch B'nei Yisrael? A historical journey struggle to display HaKadosh Baruch Hu to a world audience, even when it elicits from them hatred, hostility, death, and persecution. The vision of the Eda Kolpo Kiata Pialto, Nikol Yitzur Kiata Yitzur, that one day the entire chorus will proclaim Hashem Elokei Yisrael Melech U'machus L'Bakol Mashal. And this is the second difference. Not just in the way that we view God as wrathful or as peaceful, as desirous of human sacrifice or as compassionate and merciful, but how we define this act of dying on God's behalf. Make no mistake about it. There is a gulf of difference between a suicide bomber who serves his own petty, egotistical interests and the great tradition of Mesiras Nefesh al Kiddush Hashem. The third difference, which to me is the most pivotal one, speaks not about the way in which we define our God or the way in which we view this experience, but the way in which we view the relationship between our two worlds, Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba. A Jew lives in two worlds, in two domains, in two realms: the present, material, concrete realm, and the eternal, future life of Olam Haba. How do we view the interaction between these two worlds? What is the dynamic between our experience in this world and what awaits us in the next world? Here too, we look to Chazal for it. Source number 7 relates to the episode in Parshas Vayera where HaKadosh Baruch Hu demanded that Avraham send Yishmael. Discard Yishmael. The process of selection is continuing. The chosen seed, the discarded seed. Kol asher tomar elecha Sarah shema bekola. My wife's favorite pasuk. Whatever Sarah tells you, listen to her. Good advice for marriage. Kol asher tomar elecha Sarah shema bekola. Listen to Sarah. Ki bi Yitzchak yikari lecha Sarah. Because Yitzchak is your chosen seed. Yitzchak is your future. Yitzchak is your destiny. Of course, this pasuk carries one extra letter. The letter beis. The Torah could have written, Ki Yitzchak yikari l'chazara. Yitzchak will be called your seed. Why does the Torah, which doesn't waste words or letters or even crowns on the tops of letters, why does the Torah write, why does Hashem tell Avram, Ki bi Yitzchak, beis, bi Yitzchak, yikari l'chazara? So Chazal wrote the extra beis, and of course, interpreted as follows. I'm going to review them. Source number 7. Yitzchak ain't sitkan. Doesn't say Yitzchak. Ela bi Yitzchak. Reb Azariah b'shem barachatya. Reb Azariah amplified Reb Yudan's statement. Beis, the letter beis, which is spotlighted in this pasuk, is train, is two. B'mi, Medrash continues, second line, second word, source number 7. B'mi, shumoda, b'shnei olamos. The beis signifies Yitzchak's uniqueness, because Yitzchak acknowledges beis olamos. When I first read this medrash, I interpreted it in a simple manner. Yitzchak is a vision of Olam Haba. Yitzchak is not shackled to this world, and therefore he is selected. I don't believe that's true textually, nor do I think it's true experientially, historically. Are we the only people? Are we the only religion with a vision of the afterlife? Are we the only culture which acknowledges Olam Haba? What Chazal are underlining is that Yitzchak's unique capacity is to acknowledge, to embrace, and ultimately to bridge two worlds at once. Our world is divided by and large into two very, very different cultures. Some cultures are so mired in the concrete reality of the day-to-day, of the material world, the palpable presence, that they've completely abdicated a sense of the afterworld, of the next life, the secular city. And yet other cultures are so enchanted by the promises of an elusive afterlife, a utopian realm, that they flee from our own world, from its challenges, from its imperfections, from its mission. A Jew has the capacity to stand atop of both worlds. You cannot get to Olam Haba by murdering people in this world. That act reflects the way in which you view the two worlds, as separate, as detached. I can commit the most grievous crime, the most murderous behavior, and use that very behavior as my ticket to the next world. Such an attitude is unconscionable. To get to heaven, we have to take it there with us. The next world is an extension of our experiences, of our spiritual level, of our encounter with the Kodesh Baruch Hu in this world, without the hindrances, without the impediments, without the obstacles. But we don't seek reward, we seek results. We don't look for prizes. For us, Olam Haba is a natural consequence. It's a bridge. As the Rambam makes in Hilchos Tshuva, source number 8, Al Yomar Adam, Harini Osa Mitzvah Tara, the Osek B'Chach Masa, a person should not say, I will perform the Torah's will and study its wisdom, Kidesha, Kabel, Kola, Bracha, Saksumazva, to merit all the rewards and blessings. Oh, Kidesha, Eskil, Achayo, Amaba, that I'll get to the next world. Or the Ephroshrin Haveiro, Shasira Taraman, I will abstain from sin, Kidesha, and not say, I should be saved and rescued, Menachlalos, and the curses, Saksuvas, Matara. Oh, Kidesha, Lorakaris, Michayo, Amaba, I should be spared, I should not be cut off in the next world. It's not the goal of the religious identity. A person who serves God solely for reward and a fear of punishment, who obey the Yira, is quaking in a corner, shaking and trembling at God's wrath. The is not the level of the prophet, nor the chacham. You know who serves God this way? Again, excuse the anachronism. There's no shamanism intended. This is the Rambam's historical and social reality. You know who serves God this way? Ignorant people. In those days, women, unfortunately, were ignorant. Baruch Hashem, today, they're no longer just the post on the arts. Baktanim, children. We train them to fear. Until they get a conscience, until they get a will, until they get an intellect, then they can start to love God. By the way, there's a very important statement in this Rambam about Chinuch. Chinuch has to start with Yira. But the Rambam writes, Ha'obei the Ahava, source number, actually number 8, part 2, Halacha Beis. Ha'obei the Ahava, Osek the Torah of the Mitzvos, he serves the Kodesh Baruch Hu. He pursues knowledge and wisdom. Not for any ulterior purpose. It isn't the means. Not because he fears evil. Not to inherit the good. And here's one of those phrases that I recommend you sort of retaining, memorizing. Ela ose ha'emes. Mipnei shehu emes. He does what is right because it is right. V'self hatov alav u'beglala. And of course, the good life will come as a product, will extend. Osa has MS and a sense of deep-seated conviction that this is the highest and most noble lifestyle that a person can aspire towards. Sometimes I challenge the Talmidim and Yeshiva with the following question. What would happen if Hashem came to you in a dream this evening, for example, and offered you tomorrow as a freebie? Tomorrow you're off. I would say Sunday, but I'm from Eretz Yisrael, but I'm off on Sunday. No rewards, no punishments. No prohibitions, no restrictions. Eat what you'd like, taste what you'd like, take what you'd like, touch what you'd like, act as you'd like. What would you do? If you accept the Rambam's challenge, and you see yourself as the seed of Yitzchak, ki bi Yitzchak, your answer should be, I would not change one single iota. Get up to daven, try to perform chesed to the best of the capacity, live an honest, ethical lifestyle, study God, explore His world, study His Torah, live an upstanding lifestyle, because it's right. Because it's the most redemptive experience known to man. But because I'll merit the next world. Does the Torah even mention Olam Haba? Is there ever a hint, a reference, a sign of the next world? If you follow the mitzvahs and the commandments, your El Malkosh, you'll live an abstinent, disciplined, profound, meaningful life of fulfillment, rather than a capricious and irresponsible life of indulgence. Yitzchak's unique capacity is to be stride two worlds, to maintain that firm and unwavering vision of the next world that's perfect, which cannot be shattered by the evil and the hardships of this world, but to embrace the world, to improve it, to excel at it. A Jew wavers between imminence and transcendence, between the present material world, between the future eternal world. I have a brother-in-law who, before he made Aliyah, was a rabbi in Miami, in actually southern Florida, in Boca Raton. And his responsibilities as a rav included traveling through the various hospital wards and homes for the aged, and visiting some of the people who were natural members of the congregation, others who had just migrated to Florida. He told me the following story. Once was walking through the hallways, and he heard a man hallucinating in his bed, an elderly man. My malachim, I'm coming. My malachim, I'm coming. I'm coming, my malachim. My brother-in-law was obviously quite interested in this man's tale. He waited a few moments for this man to become a little bit more lucid. He asked him, what do you mean that you're coming to your malachim? The man recounted the following story. He was a youngster who was also pulled out in Europe to a different Umschleimplatz, to a different gathering point, on the way to the concentration camps. And that day happened to be Erev Simchas Torah, Erev Shemini Atzeres, or Erev Shemini Atzeres. And he was tugging on his father's coat, Tati, Tati, Hakafos, Hakafos. We're going to miss Hakafos, we're going to miss Hakafos. How could they be taking us somewhere? You know the excitement the child feels for our couples. So the German SS guard, Yimach Shemo, wasn't enough for them to murder us, but to play with our minds, torture us before they killed us. He heard this little boy begging his father for our couples. He says, you want our couples? Come. And he pulled him from his father, grabbed a few other youngsters and said, make our couples. Grab some people to play music. Here we go, our couples. The boy started dancing. The German guard pulled out his revolver and started to play Russian roulette with the children. One by one. The bullet locked finally, and he murdered one of their friends in cold blood. And the kids jumped back in horror. But the SS guard said, "Who told you to stop dancing? Keep dancing. You're one of the couples here, you're a couples." This monster forced them, these little kids, to dance over the slain body of their friends. One by one, these children emerged as they continue to dance with the flowing blood of their friend. Finally, there are two kids left standing. And as they dance, this vicious game continues, and one of the children is killed. This final young child continues dancing. The SS agent turns to him and says, "Who are you dancing with? Your children, your friends have been killed. Who are you dancing with?" This little child looks up at the SS guard and says, "I'm dancing with my malach." And he continues to dance. And the SS guard put his gun back in and just walked away. And every single year, this young man who grew into an older adult received a special hakafa in his shul. The entire shul would clear out the center, and he would have a long hakafa. And it was known as the malachim dance. And each year, he would dance with his malachim. And here he was, about to meet those malachim. Of course, we're not just the people of this world. Of course, we live, our courage draws itself from our vision, our keen sense of the next world, the God in heaven, Melech Malachim Lachim HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We don't escape this world. We don't chas v'shalom murder in this world. We certainly don't murder to get to the next world. The unique capacity of a Jew to bridge the two worlds, to unify the two experiences. Of course, we march through this world as a passageway, as a prosdor, viewing the next world as a trochlei, as a palace. And of course, all of our efforts are invested in reaching that trochlei, in reaching that palace. But we do not ignore the prosdor. We do not ignore this world. We see it as a passageway, which is integrally linked to the next world. It's one building, one bridge, one continuum. Those are the three differences.